Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former Boulder, Colorado radio DJ, rock frontman, and former San Diego, California concert promoter, Kenny Weisberg. He just published a funny, insightful memoir, Off My Rocker, One Man's Tasty, Twisted, Star-Studded Quest for Everlasting Music. Stick around. We'll get to the bottom of what's wrong with brown M&Ms if it's the last thing we do. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that demands stretch limos from here to there, classic Ms. Pac-Man video games, payment in cash, white Marley-covered flooring, use of my private office, a seamstress, a hairdresser, 24 dethorned roses a day, and a douchebag. Oh, I'm sorry, that's just Gallagher. In the Nuna Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. As a writer, I know the importance of a good opening. I think the best one I ever wrote was at the start of a book called The Profit Zone. I didn't understand a lot of the economic theory my co-author was describing, but I did encapsulize one of his primary views pretty simply. Market share is dead. So when I started reading Kenny Weisberg's new autobiography, Off My Rocker, I was looking for a compelling reason to go on. After all, I had never heard of Kenny. Other than us both growing up in New Jersey, I couldn't make a connection. He was a longtime FM radio disc jockey in Boulder, Colorado. I've never been there. He fronted his own band there for a while, Kenny and the Critics. Never done that either. And while I've been to San Diego once, the waterfront venue there, in which he later made his reputation as a concert promoter, Humphreys, was not on my radar. So, when his book opens on the day of December 10th, 1967, he really needed to win me over quickly. He did. The first story in Off My Rocker is about Kenny and two pals cutting class at the University of Wisconsin to buy tickets to see Otis Redding and the Barclays. A few weeks later, Kenny and his friends are outside the factory, that's a venue, on the day of the show waiting for the doors to open, only to discover that Redding and his mates have died in a plane crash on the way to the gig. It was jarring and sad, but it was very consuming to a reader. I no longer had to care about whether I knew Kenny or not. I wanted to read his story. And if you love rock and roll, have an interest in learning about life behind the scenes in the music business, you'll find this entire book irresistible. Kenny Weisberg, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Mr. Media. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, do you want to fill in a little bit more on the drama of that day that the music died for you?
I was a huge Otis Redding fan. I'm trying to see. I just happened to bring this with me today for the interview.
Okay.
I had grown up in New Jersey and listened to a radio station called WWRL. It was 1600 AM, and it was all black soul music. And I just got so emotionally involved whenever they would play Otis Redding that I said, maybe one day I'll get a chance to see him. I was a sophomore at the University of Wisconsin. The tickets went on sale. They cost $3 in advance. I think they were $3 the night of the show, too. And so we went down, we bought some tickets, and then I set up a big calendar in my dormitory room, and it was like a prisoner counting the days till he gets out of jail. I counted the days down until Otis Redding was going to appear in Madison, Wisconsin. So we got there. It was a 6:30 show, and we got there at about 3:30 in the afternoon, and it was freezing. We had a thermos of hot chocolate. We were jogging in place. We were singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T. We were doing everything we could to keep warm. And the doors were supposed to open at 6 o'clock, and we wanted to get right up next to the stage. I just couldn't wait. I had only seen Otis on television. Galvanizing performer, just, you know, one of the most unbelievable live performers ever. And the door didn't open at 6, and we're freezing, and the line is growing longer and longer, and people start staccato clapping, open the door, and they didn't. And then all of a sudden it was 6:30, it was supposed to be showtime, and the manager of the venue came to the door with a bullhorn and also with a placard announcing that Otis Redding and the Barclays had been in a plane crash, and that tickets could be refunded at the back door. And everyone ran to get their $3 refunds, and all of a sudden my friends and I were standing there alone, as we had been leading up to the concert. We got there first. We were alone at 3:30, and all of a sudden at 7 o'clock we're alone again, and we start crying. And, you know, we take the long trip back to our dormitory, the 1 mile walk. And I said, wait a second, they didn't say he was dead, so let's run back and turn on the radio. We turn on the radio. It was announced that he was dead. In fact, I still have the ticket to the show. Don't know how you can see
that. Wow, yeah, that's great. And folks, that's why we do video interviews.
Yeah, so... That night, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't believe what had just happened. I mean, it was confirmed that he and the Barclays were dead. And the next day, we found out the trumpeter, Ben Cawley, of the Barclays had somehow survived and was rescued. And he's still alive, as a matter of fact. I ran down to the record store, got the only two LPs that I hadn't gotten in my Otis Redding collection. And his soul, I know it sounds a little hokey, and I'm not, you know, an overly spiritual person, but I felt his soul kind of enter my body that night and the next day. And I determined at that point in time that I was going to devote the rest of my life to music because of what had just happened. And my parents were kind of pushing me to go into a career in law or medicine. You grew up in New Jersey, I'm sure. You might have been under the same pressures.
Maybe.
But I decided that night, the night that Otis Redding died, that I was going to devote the rest of my life to music, and I have.
Well, and I was thinking that I've known a lot of guys over the years, especially growing up in New Jersey. It was either music or comic books for most of them, or sports, I guess, who had the same kind of music connection that you did. I know I felt very strongly about music growing up in the 60s and the early 70s, but very few actually made an actual career of it, as you did. What made you committed to rock and roll to the point that, I mean, became your life? And why do you think it was different for you than, you know, maybe the other two guys that you were going to go to the concert with, for example?
Well, it's an interesting question, because for so many years it was a career, but I hardly made any money doing it. When I was 8 years old, I was listening to AM radio in New York, and some of my favorite disc jockeys were Peter Tripp and Murray the K. Kaufman and Scott Muni and Alan Freed and all these people that became legendary. I was listening to them when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and I was transfixed. I used to sit by the transistor radio when Peter Tripp would count down the top 40 every Wednesday night, and I would write down number 40, the Crystals, number 39, you know, Gene Pitney, et cetera, et cetera. And at my 8th birthday party, I said to my parents, I'm going to be a disc jockey. And they laughed and chuckled. And I told all my friends, I'm going to be a disc jockey. And then finally, when I ended up in Boulder in 1971, I fell in love with this radio station, KRNW. It was an underground FM station. And I listened to it every day. I didn't know that I was going to end up staying in Boulder. But through a series of circumstances that I write about in Off My Rocker, I met the morning guy there, and we became friends, and he sort of finagled to get me into the station on the substitute list, but I kind of fudged how much experience I had had. I lied.
Okay.
But I talked a good game, and eventually, less than a month later, my friend left the station in Boulder, recommended that I take over his morning slot, and I did. And being on the radio, I write about it in the book. I didn't know what I was doing. I was called into the station to do my first show. I had never been in a radio station before, even though I said I had 4 years of experience. So I went in there. I faked my way through the first six-hour shift and became sort of natural at it. I mean, it became I was living out my fantasy in being an FM disc jockey at the time. That kind of led to almost everything else that I write about in Off My Rocker. Listeners would call in that were editors of periodicals, newspapers, magazines. They really enjoyed what I had to say on the radio, and they convinced me that I should be writing about it, that I should become a critic, that I should do features, that I should do record reviews. And so I said, okay. And when you say, how did you, you know, have a career doing this? Well, I was paid $5 per record review and $15 for, you know, 3,000 word features. And you know, it wasn't, and I was paid $1.60 an hour to be on the radio. So I just, it was all a labor of love, and I was living hand to mouth in a lot of ways. And eventually I ended up in putting a band together, because people that listened to my radio show and read my reviews would say things to me like, oh, I'd like to see what you can do. If you think you're so great, let's see what you could do. And I put a band together at age 32. And then someone that used to listen to me on the radio called me up out of the blue, said, I just moved to California. I'm starting a concert company. I'm rescuing a dying concert company in San Diego. Do you want to come work for me? And the series of circumstances that led to me becoming a concert promoter are pretty harrowing. I said yes, but little did I know the trouble that I'd be getting myself into by relocating from Boulder to San Diego. I kind of write about that in explicit detail in Off My Rocker. And so it was just a calling. That's about all I can say. And I went through many, many, many lean years before moving into the concert business. I finally learned how to make a living. I didn't know how to make a living for the longest time.
It's interesting. I remember being in my room when I was very young and having my turntable. And this sounded very familiar in your book, wanting to spin records. So, you know, then you would try to get a second turntable, and you'd go back and forth, and you'd try to think of what to say. And I never had anything good to say, but I loved spinning the records. And my little brother took over years later. He discovered Elvis and took my turntables, my little plastic turntables, and he would open his bedroom door, turn on the turntable, and get everybody gathered around, and he would imitate Elvis. And he you know, wanted to be a disc jockey, and he wanted to be a performer. And that's what he wound up doing. He became a party disc jockey, and I give him credit for that. You were recording yourself, introducing records and doing stuff. I mean, you just went through a 20-year period of your life, 20-plus years. I'm going to slow it back down and go back a little bit with you, because you skipped over some good stuff there. Do you think it was easier in the early days of FM to just kind of appear and you know, walk into a radio station than it would be today? Or do you think it's actually in some ways similar to today, where you could start your own internet radio station, I guess, or your own band, because you could be online?
Yeah, the internet has changed everything, obviously. Commercial radio is not what it used to be when we grew up listening to it. I had a lot of chutzpah back then to lie about my experience, and I don't recommend that anyone that's listening this that aspires to be in radio does the same thing. But I just knew what I wanted to do, and I there are several chapters about how when I was a kid, for my 11th birthday, I had saved my allowance and I got a Wolensack reel-to-reel recorder. I wish I had an image of that. They were such great old machines. Yeah. I don't have it. I really wish that I still had it. It's a reel-to-reel 3¾-inch recorder. And so the records would come on. I'd play the records, and then I'd take the handheld microphone and start back announcing. And so when I started doing radio, I knew what I wanted to say and how I wanted to talk. And in underground radio, as opposed to radio today, which this stuff almost doesn't exist, the disc jockeys were counted on to have a knowledge of music. They played whatever we wanted to play. I mean, the first station I worked for had 10,000 vinyl LPs on the wall, and I could literally go up. If I wanted to play everything that began with the letter A, I would go and I'd get Andelman and I'd put it on the turntable, and all of a sudden, you know, I could do a whole themes show with, you know, Paul Anka, Joan Armatrading, you know, whatever the animals, whatever it would be. You can't do that anymore. So a lot of the joy of being knowledgeable and loving music and wanting to go into radio to express your own individual personality, that's gone. What exists today is music as a buffer between commercials, and you have to play the hits on 95% of the music stations. You have to play the hits to hold the audience for the next 6-minute block of commercials. Back then, we hardly had any commercials. We would sell 30-second commercials to the car dealer down the street for $2 a piece. And so we would literally play an hour of music and then cut and do 2 live commercials or something like that. So it was a whole form of self-expression that doesn't really exist on the radio. If I was breaking into radio now and I had the same desires and aspirations, I couldn't do it.
You'd have to work for an internet station these days to...
Yeah, and like you say, start your own.
Right, and you would earn the same $1.60 that you did 40 or 50 years ago.
If I was lucky.
Yeah. I mean, because internet radio don't pay the bills. Now, you did have some interesting experiences. There were 2 particular guests. One of the great things about radio in that time, not besides the fact that you could choose your own records and play what appealed to you and avoid the stuff that didn't, was that it was an era when guests were likely to drop by an underground FM station or a freeform FM station, as they later became known. You had 2 that stood out in my mind. You had Elvis Costello come through, I think, on his first tour. And yes. I think it was after that sometime you had Bill Murray pop up. Can you tell folks a little about those 2 guests of yours?
Yeah. Well, the Elvis Costello was on his first tour. I think it was in 1978. And he was defining himself as this angry young punk rocker, even though the music on My Aim Is True is not all that punk. Like, it's not Sex Pistols or Clash punk. But he was dressing the role in, you know, like tight stiletto, you know, skin tight pants, stiletto heels. Skinny tie, and he came into the station and literally was as nice as could be off the air. He asked, you know, could he play some music? Did I have any Ian Matthews? Could I play Johnny Paycheck's Take This Job and Shove It? And he was as polite as could be. The microphone went on. He went right into character, and every time I would ask him a question, he'd go, "That's the stupidest question I've ever heard in my fucking life," you know. And his manager, Jake Riviera, was sitting next to him, goading him. You know, when he would start getting out of character and being nice again, his manager would go, no. And so he'd start being angry, and he was just totally off color. And then I'd play a record. I'd play one of his songs from his debut album, My Aim Is True. And the microphone would go off. The record would play, and he'd go, "Is it okay? You know, are we doing it?" Yeah, he was as nice as could be. And I ended up befriending him that day. I've never seen him again, but I drove him to his concert that night, and his career took off. And I think he's one of the most diverse, talented people in music for the past 35 years. I love Elvis Costello. Bill Murray was interesting. I used to get phone calls from listeners all the time that would want to get together, and they'd want to meet me and have lunch or pick my brain. And for the most part, I remember when I tried to do that with certain disc jockeys when I was growing up, people would hang up on me and I'd never get to meet them. And I said, you know something, I'm going to be a different kind of person. I'm going to be more accessible. And so I got a call from a woman named Mickey, just left a name and number, and I called her back, and it turned out that she had just moved to Boulder. She was selling mail order woks from her kitchen in Boulder. And she said, well, you know, so I met her, told her, she said, I used to be in the TV business in New York, and I burned out. I moved out here. Didn't mention anything about who her boyfriend was, but she said, my boyfriend's coming out. He'd really like to meet you. Turned out that it was Bill Murray, and he had just started on Saturday Night Live, maybe about 6 months before that. And all of a sudden, I'm meeting Bill Murray. He's in my house in Boulder. He's going through my albums, and I asked him to be on the show. And he came down several times over the years, he basically took the whole show over. And I still have little cassettes of that I will digitize one of these days, but I haven't done that yet. One day I walked into the radio station, and I realized that there was a microphone across the table from me, an auxiliary mic, and none of the other disc jockeys on my station were doing interviews, and I just realized, well, there are two microphones here. I guess that means I should be talking to someone.
I was thinking about your Elvis Costello story, and I was thinking back to when I was interviewing I was a music critic for the St. Petersburg Times in the early 80s, and also some music magazines, as you were, local weeklies and stuff like that. And I'm trying to think now, do I have to excuse the behavior of the guy in Simply Red now because he was just being an act? Because I've always maintained that he was just a pure asshole. The girls from Bananarama, who I got to interview at a club late one night, and they were just utter you know what I mean? I think the word starts with a bitch. Oops. Yeah, that's how it starts.
I know.
Were they putting on an act? I don't know. They really seemed to be very convincing.
Well, Elvis was definitely putting on an act.
Yeah.
I've met other people that aren't very nice and just couldn't wait for the interview to be over. Graham Parsons, who died.
That was
way
a good story.
Young.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that story's in there in detail, but he was a total dick.
Yeah.
And the only reason I even got the interview was because the club that he was playing at, with Emmylou Harris as his backup singer and Paramore at the time, mm-hmm. The club was closed, shackled, for non-payment of rent or something like that, and they had to move it on the fly to the Pioneer Inn up in Nederland, Colorado. And he needed to get the word out because the show was that night, and the club had all his equipment and it was closed and shackled and locked. And so he had to do the interview. And then I was a huge Birds fan. I don't know if I brought out some of my favorite records, but one of my favorite groups and records of all time, the Birds. So Graham Parsons had been a member of the Birds, and I had all these questions about he had refused to go on tour of South Africa with the Birds because of the apartheid laws and dropped off the tour. And so I wanted to ask him about that. And so I would ask him a very informed question about leaving the Birds and taking Chris Hillman with him, et cetera, et cetera. And he wouldn't answer the questions. He goes, I just want to talk about the Pioneer Inn. I'm moving the gig. And so then I said, is it true that when you formed the Flying Burrito Brothers, you took Chris Hillman with you from the Birds and tried to get Roger McGuinn to disband the Birds and join the Flying Burrito Brothers? I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the Pioneer Inn. And he finally grabbed the microphone. It was a flexible gooseneck microphone, the auxiliary mic, and he broke it in half. I don't think he meant to, but he just grabbed it, and he was, and so Emmylou Harris was crocheting socks for her infant daughter in the corner, and I look over and I go, what's the problem? And she just shrugs her shoulder. She got him. He had been drinking Annie Greensprings grape rosé from a bottle in a brown paper bag. I mean, just a total derelict. I feel bad that he died 6 months later, that was probably the hardest interview of my career.
Now, just out of curiosity, did you record these interviews?
I recorded maybe 50%. Unfortunately, I didn't record that one, but I have a lot of the interviews on cassette and reel-to-reel. I have not done anything about making them available or tweaking them. They're all on really thin reel-to-reel tape. And one of these days, my publisher is really anxious for me to digitize these, especially I have 3 hours of me and Bill Murray, which is hysterical.
Yeah.
Some of those stuff is just so hysterical. I mean, one of the voices he was using, it was in character, and it became the guy in Caddyshack 2 years later. He was practicing with that voice, when Caddyshack comes out, I think his name was Carl Spackler. He was the greens attendant in Caddyshack. I hear this voice, and I go, wait a second. I played the cassette back after seeing the movie, and it was that voice. So, yeah, I have a bunch of them on tape. There are others, like I was doing, I interviewed Jim Croce also a few months before he died, and I didn't even think to tape it because I didn't like his AM hit single, You Don't Mess Around With Jim. I was doing the interview as a favor to the club owner. I wasn't looking forward to it, so I didn't record that. He comes in with his partner, Maury Muehleisen, playing the most intricate acoustic guitar parts. My jaw just dropped. It just showed me that I shouldn't prejudge someone based on a force-fed AM radio single. I should keep an open mind. And I had told him before the interview began that they could play one song, and I really didn't have that long. And then after the first song, I kept going, can you do one more?
Yeah.
Kept them there for an hour, but alas, I don't have it. I have the memory in my head.
Mm. Well, one of the other interesting zigs, I guess, that your career took was while you're in Colorado. I guess you were out of work at the radio station, and you started a band, Kenny and the Critics. I would have to guess that would be the single ballsiest thing you ever did in your life, because let's face it, every rock critic thinks he knows so much about how it should be done and what's wrong with this one, what's right with that one. You actually did it. I give you a lot of credit for that.
Thanks. And your assessment, without even knowing me, is accurate. When the Beatles hit the States in 1964, I was 16, and like everyone else, I went out and bought a Stella acoustic guitar, and I learned Beatles songs. But when I went away to college 2 years later, my parents thought it would be too much of a distraction for me to take the guitar, so they refused to let me take my guitar to college. And I kind of dropped it, and I ended up playing other people's music on the radio. I ended up writing about other people's music in newspapers, but I never made my own music, and it was always gnawing at me, but I never did anything about it. This same guy who's the drummer of the Byrds, Michael Clark, had moved to Boulder in the mid-70s and joined a band called Firefall that had a couple of AM hits in the 70s. And I had written very enthusiastically about Firefall's first album. But then their second and third came out. They seemed to be lazier to me. And as opposed to being just a homer and cheering for the home team, and I wrote for the Boulder Daily Camera. This was a Boulder-based band, the most commercially successful band ever to come out of Boulder, arguably. And so I just wrote, this isn't very good. So I was at a club that night that the Firefall review came out, and Michael Clark, who was a friend, I so admired his work in the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. He came up to me in the club, grabbed me like this, backed me into the wall, and said, "How can you be so freaking negative?" And then he relaxed his grip and he said, "I agree with you, but I sure would like to see what you could do. If you think you're so good, why don't you take the stage?" And so I went up, I took that to heart, and I said, he's right. I really would like to see what I could do. I was going to put together a band of 18-year-old kids that might – I was 32, and I'd still never been in a band. But I was interviewing Mark Andes, who had been the bass player here. There's another
– you're turning into a bit of a prop DJ. So I don't want to hear any criticism later of Gallagher, the prop comedian.
Well, anyway, Spirit was one of my all-time favorite bands. They had their one hit was "I've Got a Line on You," but four albums of theirs were just incredible. And the bass player in Spirit was Mark Andes, and he had moved to Boulder, ironically, and founded Firefall, the band that Michael Clark was in. It was a super group. Rick Roberts had been in the Flying Burrito Brothers. So I was interviewing Mark Andes, who had just quit Firefall. This is a few months after Michael Clark did this to me and said, "I'd like to see what you could do." And so I started telling everyone that I was going to be putting a band together, even though I had no plans, I had no game plan, nothing in mind of how to do it. And all of a sudden, I'm telling Mark Andes this. I don't know why. I had nothing in mind. And Mark Andes says to me, do you need a bass player? And he's like one of the best bass players in history, the history of rock and roll in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I said, what? He goes, well, in between gigs, I could help you do it. And so the band, Kenny and the Critics, once I had Mark Andes in there, I got Sam Broussard, who was the best guitar player in Boulder, had used to play with Jimmy Buffett. And I got the best drummer in Boulder and the best keyboard player. All of a sudden, I'm in a band with arguably the best musicians in Colorado. And I had never even sung into a microphone before. So the rest of that, you know, is explained in detail in the book. And I thought it would be a one-shot deal, that it would be, you know, one and done. But all of a sudden, I'm looking out the first night that I'm performing, and there are all these critics in the audience taking notes. And I'm just going, oh, what did I get myself into? You know, because that was me for 10 years, just sitting in the audience, taking notes. I mean, I could tell you so many stories about musicians that would come up to me after, you know, I didn't hide the fact that I was taking notes. They go, oh, God, are you reviewing this? You know, and all of a sudden, I'm looking out, and there are people taking notes. And the reviews turned out, much to my delight and surprise, to be good reviews. Mm-hmm. And so I kept the band together for 3.5 years. And it became really, I mean, it was so good for self-esteem. It was, you know, it showed me that I could do anything that I set out to do. Mm-hmm. It was such a great experience. But then it all got interrupted when I got a job offer to move to San Diego and be a concert promoter.
Well, let me tell folks, you can find... Kenny has posted some videos from that time on YouTube. The link is here on Mr. Media below the interview. If you're looking at the MrMedia.com page, below the interview is there'll be a link to the YouTube channel for Kenny. You click on that. The one I would recommend, the one I liked the best, was his version of High School Confidential. He may pick something else, but I like that one. It's the vocals very crisp. There's a lot of great interaction with the guitarists, and it's just well done. So if you want one sample of Kenny and the Critics from that era, check out High School Confidential. He's also got I'm a Rocker and some other things on there, but that was pretty remarkable. Let's move on to your time as a concert promoter before we have to wrap things up. So you've gone from you've taken the challenge of I'd like to see what you can do, going from disc jockey and music critic to rock star essentially in Boulder, and then you get this opportunity to be a concert promoter. It got off to a rough start, but it did eventually work its way out. We'll save some of the details for the book. Were you ever shocked, having been a disc jockey, which is in itself a bit of a sleazy business at times, and you played in a band, also has elements of sleaze to it, attached to it. Were you surprised? I guess I should ask, was concert promoting sleazier than the other two? And what was, you know, did anything surprise you at that point?
Yeah, first of all, again, like when I started doing radio, I had no experience. When I sang in a band, I had no experience. When I moved to San Diego to be a concert promoter, the guy that hired me was an old friend, and he said, you know, I'm going to put you to work in this office, learn the business, and make sure they're not ripping me off. Make sure that they're spending my investment properly. So I was basically a watchdog, and I ended up being... you know, the staff psychologist, because all the people that had been in the business and working together for years, and here I am, the new kid coming in, you know, and plus I was at age 35 changing careers. I was the oldest person in this office. I had to break up fist fights. There was a guy and a girlfriend that I had to separate them when they would start screaming at each other. I literally printed out cards that said Kenny Weisberg, staff psychologist. But in terms of dealing with the artists, I was kind of lucky in the sense that I never really made it to the level where I was putting on shows with the Rolling Stones or Van Halen or, you know, arena bands. I focused on this 1,400-seat venue, Humphreys. It's an outdoor venue. It was seasonal. And I was doing everything from jazz to country to, you know, soft rock to, you know, some hard rock and comedy. And so I was dealing with not the big superstars. Well, there were some that you know, deigned to play our small place. But I didn't have as much issues with the artist demands. Most of them were fantastic to deal with. Of course, I select some of the divas that I had to deal with and have a chapter in Off My Rocker called Diva Demands. And but you know, what was sleazy about the business is the agents driving up the prices to, you know, fostering bidding wars against rival promoters. The rival promoters bribing the agents with gifts and drugs, and I detail it all in the book.
Which actually did cost you your job when you played that game for a while.
Yes, it cost me my job for a couple of days, which I explain in the book. But I started behaving like the people that I had written about concert promoters when I was a critic, and they were never my favorite breed of people. And then I became one, and I said, I'm going to do this differently. But then I started succumbing to some of the demands to stay competitive and to just, you know, I became as greedy as the people that I disdained. At some point, I really had to examine, you know, do a lot of self-examination. And I actually left the business after 23. I can't believe I lasted 23 years, but I left in my prime because of the way that it was going. I explain it pretty much in the book.
I was thinking a lot about, as I was reading this, a buddy of mine who worked for Phantasma Productions here in Florida for a long time. Yeah. And then he worked out in I can't remember where he worked out, in Arizona, and now he's in San Antonio with the arena there, helping put on shows and stuff. And I'm going to send him your book when I'm done with it. You know, maybe I'll tell him about it. Let him buy his own copy. Put a couple dollars in your pocket. But, you know, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about things that I used to hear from him. Tell me a little bit about some of the people that you mentioned in the book. For example, Chuck Berry, of course, is legendary,
yeah.
Not just for his guitar work and his duck walk, but for, you know, not showing up or pulling out at the last minute. You had your own moment with him.
I did, and to be fair to my agent at the William Morris Agency, for years, whenever I would bring up, I want to book Chuck, I booked all my heroes in the early years of concert promotion. I booked the Everly Brothers, I booked Fats Domino, I booked Jerry Lee Lewis, I booked Roy Orbison. I mean, I was like a pig in, can we say pig in shit?
Okay.
I was just so happy, and Chuck Berry was one of the icons and one of my heroes. Uh-huh. But every time I would try to book him, the agent would say, "No, I want to remain your friends with you, not Chuck Berry." And it's been documented later in the Taylor Hackford documentary, "How Hell Rock and Roll," how Chuck Berry treated Keith Richards, even as a member of a band backing him up. And so finally, my agent shifted territories, and I was with a new agent. And the new agent said, "Hey, how about Chuck Berry?" And I said, "Well, I wanted to book him for years, but my agent just, you know, kept saying, 'No, I want to be your friend.'" He goes, "Oh, that's old Chuck Berry." And so I booked him in 1988, I believe, and I couldn't wait to meet him. I couldn't wait for the night to come. And then he shows up 5 minutes before showtime, and I'll let people read about it in the book, but the show almost didn't take place. There was a certain amount of extortion involved. It made me say, be careful what you wish for. I really had wished to get to know Chuck Berry and work with him on a regular basis, and it didn't happen quite like that.
I always wanted to see him play live, and over the years, I heard so many horrible stories about him. In terms of turning up and demands and not being a no-show, I probably regret this, but I never did go see him because I always felt if I paid the money for the ticket, he wasn't going to be there anyway, or he'd pull some crap, or he'd walk out, and I thought, you know, I don't know.
Well, the times I presented him twice, I mean, concert promoters have short memories, and even though he put me through all these ridiculous changes in 1988, 7 years later, I must have had the seven-year itch. I booked him again thinking, okay, he's 7 years older, it's going to be easier. It wasn't. And so 1995 was probably the last time I ever saw Chuck Berry. And in terms of you never seeing him, it would be another notch on your concert-going belt to say that you saw Chuck Berry, but he played out of tune. Mm. He forgot lyrics to songs that he had written. It was unrehearsed. I mean, promoters have to hire backup bands for Chuck Berry. And he gets there 5 minutes before the show, and the band sang to him, "What key is it in?" And he goes, "Whatever key is on the record." And then they said, "Well, do you play it exactly like it's on the record?" He goes, "If I lift my foot up, you start. And when I put my foot down, you stop." And so he did two shows in one night, and the second show was much better because the band had adjusted. Right. But he didn't care. He just wanted to go. He'd get his paycheck. He did the duck walk, and he sang his songs. But, he kept stopping in the middle of songs and saying, "I'm an old guy. You can't expect me to remember all the words." And the audience is singing along, knowing every word of his songs. He couldn't even remember his own lyrics. So you didn't miss much.
All right. Were there any artists' stories that you left out of the book for one reason or another that you'd care to tell here?
There were a lot of things. My editor judiciously cut about 100 pages. I don't know that there's going to be a sequel to this book, but the stories that I love the most, that my publisher eventually said, something, no one cares about that. There were artists that I championed, for instance, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. They're not popular outside of the tri-state area. They're popular in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, maybe Ohio. I tried bringing them out west many times, and they didn't draw that well. But I had a really nice relationship with Southside Johnny Lyon, so I wrote lovingly about that, and she chose not to put it in the book. There are other more obscure musicians that I became very good friends with. Richard Thompson, who had been a guitarist in Fairport Convention,
sure.
and the most jaw-droppingly brilliant guitarist that I've ever met. So I would write. The ones that got cut from the book were pretty much the loving homages that I have toward lesser-known people. And at KennyWeisberg.com, I'm starting to blog. I can't believe it's a 21st century and I'm just starting the blog, but I think a lot of the stories that didn't make it to Off My Rocker will make it into blog form at KennyWeisberg.com.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, I think in reading the book, I hit on the reason for your enduring success, and it seems to be your wife.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you're going to make me tear up. You're absolutely right, and she'll be embarrassed to finally see this played back and hear you mention that. But I met my next door neighbor in 1972 through a series of circumstances that I write about in the book, and she's an artist, and had two children that I became friends with her kids, who were 6 and 7 at the time, before I even became friends with my wife. And she stood by me through thick and thin when I was unemployed and broke and having to support a wife and two stepchildren. I said, "I want to put a band together." And the artist and her said, "Well, then do it." I said, "But I'm going to not only not make money, I'm going to lose money doing it." She said, "If it's what you want to do, do it." And I can point to many examples over the 42 years we've been together where she has told me to just do what's in my heart, to go for it. And the fact that I eventually earned a living and have made us comfortable and kind of set for life is because she followed me out here to live in San Diego. We left our teenage kids back in Boulder for me to take this job and switch careers. And the move was not an easy one. Mm-hmm. I have a granddaughter now named Shira, who has read Off My Rocker. And I reveal a lot of stuff about character traits that I've displayed over the years that are not good, that my dark side. And Shira read it, and she knew none of these things about me growing up. And she said, "Grandma, how could you have stayed with Grandma?" And Helen said, You know, that's a good question. I don't entirely know the answer, but, you know, we're soulmates. So thanks for bringing her up. Her name is Helen Redman, and she's an incredible artist. And you should Google Helen Redman and see her art.
She's got a website, right?
Birthing the Crone.
Birthing the Crone. C-R-O-N-E. All right.
Birthingthecrone.com. She's sensational, and you know, we're about to celebrate our 42nd year together.
I was going to say, Helen, for 42 years with this man, you get a free plug. it's all I can offer, but hey, you know, make of it what you will. Folks, listen, you can find Kenny Weisberg's Peek Behind the Rock and Roll Curtain, Off My Rocker, One Man's Tasty, Twisted, Star-Studded Quest for Everlasting Music. It's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. You know the drill by now. If you're watching it on MrMedia.com, below the video, somewhere over there or over there, is the cover of the book. Click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. You can have it delivered electronically, perhaps, instantly, or if you want a hardcover paper, a hardback paper version, you can have it in a day or two. Just click there, order a copy. I guarantee you're going to love this book if you have any interest in music, any experience in any of these industries, too. I think you'll get a kick out of it. Kenny, I think you mentioned that you have a website. Is it KennyWeisberg.com?
Yeah, KennyWeisberg.com, and Weisberg is Weissberg. And if you order it through my website, I'll sign it and send it out to you, a signed copy. That's the one thing, unfortunately, you can't do by ordering a book at Amazon. And Mr. Media, my only regret about not being in radio and television anymore is that I can't turn the tables and interview you, because your life is pretty damn fascinating, too.
Yeah, tell my daughter. and I know you're on Facebook. Are you on Twitter as well?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm not a real active tweeter, but I should be. I mean, I'm a first-time author. This is yet another new adventure for me in my long life of first adventures. So I have to learn how to play the game better than I've played it so far. But at KennyWeisberg.com, you can read blogs and see all future appearances. And, of course, this podcast will be posted there as well.
Very cool.
Thank you so much, Mr. Media, for your time today.
My pleasure. Kenny Weisberg, thanks so much for joining us on Mr. Media, and good luck.
Thanks a lot.